We're talking about specifically the 19th century, the 1800s, and we said that was, you know, overall was a pretty good decade for century for Christianity in the West. In many ways, we kind of see the height of Christian civilization permeating many things. We see missionaries going around out around the world. We see definitely kind of a cultural Christianity that is at its peak. We talked about the Second Great Awakening, which was this big religious revival, and churches grew, new denominations started during that time. We also talked about many of the reforms of the 1800s, of the 19th century, including the movement to abolish slavery. We said a lot of that was rooted in people who were inspired by their religious faith, particularly Christianity, but a lot of that came out of the Second Great Awakening, where people saw, you know, there was these moral causes that needed to be taken on, like the abolishment of slavery, even establishing more opportunities for women, reforming the mental asylum system, and down the list, prohibition of alcohol. That was a big thing that grew during that time. So there's kind of all these moral crusades, and a lot of those are rooted in, I mean, almost all of them are led by people who are saying, you know, our faith is inspiring us to do that. We said, you know, some of the downside of this, we definitely see like a moralization, maybe a focus on the morals as opposed to so much simply the grace of God. We also see some of the things, we said the Second Great Awakening is especially very much more Arminian, you know, this kind of decision theology, which is putting, again, more of the onus on the individual as opposed to the sovereignty of God. We said the First Great Awakening was much more Calvinistic. The Second Great Awakening is much more Arminian. And we see a lot of things happen with that. And we talked about Charles Finney and a lot of the things that he did. We also talked about, I think, toward the end a little bit, that we see the United States especially becoming much more religiously diverse throughout the 1800s, right? And we said there's really two reasons for that. One is all these new denominations are starting from the Second Great Awakening, including, we said, like the Seventh-day Adventists, you have the Latter-day Saints, the Mormons, all these groups come out of this time period. But the other big reason, I think we touched on just a little bit at the end, why America becomes very religiously diverse. Well, let's back up for a second. How could this even happen? Well, because when the founders put together the Constitution, they did something that was pretty unique for that time. What did they say about religion in America when they drafted the Constitution, specifically the Bill of Rights? What did they say that was kind of a new thing, kind of an experiment in some ways?
Freedom.
Okay, you have religious freedom. So what does that mean, that we have religious freedom in America? Okay, yeah, people can choose whatever religion they want to follow or don't want to follow, right? Without, it says, you know, Congress shall make no law establishing a religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So basically, people are free to exercise their religion. Now, whenever you talk about any of the Bill of Rights, and there's all these court cases, how far does that go? I mean, obviously, there's limits to all those rights. I mean, just to choose an easy one, if your religion says you're supposed to kidnap babies and sacrifice them, can you do that? No, okay? So there's limits to all, because you say, well, that's harming someone else. You know, if your religion says we should overthrow the government, can you do that? No, okay? So there's obviously limits in different court cases on that, but apart from that, if you're not hurting other people, we've said, well, you know, you're pretty much free to believe and practice as you see fit. And the other piece of that is, what don't we have in America? We even had this in colonial America in some of the colonies, but what does the Bill of Rights say? Okay, you can freely practice a religion, but what aren't we going to have in America?
State.
Right, a state religion. We're not going to have a state religion. Now, again, you study history and all the documents. I mean, obviously, this idea of Christianity has been the dominant view in America, and we have kind of this civil religion in a way, saying, well, even what is our national motto? In God we trust, right? It's on our money. We see early leaders, you know, appealing to God, the presidents swearing in on the Bible and things like that. So there's certainly an intersection where this Judeo-Christian, especially Christian idea is permeating society, but we don't have a state church, which is the norm, even in many places of the world today. Even if they have more religious freedom, say in England, you can practice whatever religion you want, but they still have a state church, don't they? They still have an official church I saw this again in the news this week because it's coming up. Who's the head of the Church of England? The king. So this is going to be Charles, right? I guess de facto now, but officially when he's coronated, there'll be the archbishop will be there, and that's part, if you watch that, you'll see that's part of the ceremony. You know, he is going to be installed as the head of the Church of England, for better or worse, right? And we kind of chuckled about that, but again, you think of some of the monarchs through history, some of them have been more, you know, overtly, you know, Christian, others have not. I mean, Henry VIII, he even had his own motivations for doing that. But we don't see that in America. You know, we don't have an official church in America. When the president is inaugurated, when Biden or Trump swore in, there was nothing about, well, you will be the head of the Church of America or anything like that. Okay? All right? So we don't have that. Okay? That's different. We don't have, when we pay taxes, our tax dollars do not go to support a certain church. Okay? And as we've studied in the class, we see there are some definite advantages to that, because when the church and the state become intertwined, it's usually the church that suffers in the long run, right? Because you're giving politicians, for a lot, you know, control over the church and at least influence over it. Okay? So because America has said we have no state church and you can practice your religion freely, what has happened? Well, also, America has been a desirable place for many people to come over the years, hasn't it? A lot of people have wanted to come here, and they do want to come here today, right? And they come here for a variety of reasons, but one of those reasons has been religious freedom. I mean, there's economic opportunities, there's political freedom, all these things, but there's also religious freedom, okay? So because we've had all this immigration over the years, what has happened to the religious landscape of America? Very diversified, right? And we can study the different waves of immigration, right? And immigrants would bring their religion with them. So we see that very early in American history, but certainly you get the wave of immigration right before the Civil War with the Germans and the Irish especially. Then you get to, say, 1880 to 1900, this great or the new immigration, we call it in history. And you've got a lot of folks coming in from Asia on the West Coast, especially. You know, you California folks are probably more familiar with that. We kind of forget about that here on the East Coast. But lots of Chinese people came in during the Gold Rush times. They eventually cut that off with the Chinese Exclusion Act, but a lot of Chinese came in. Then a lot of Japanese folks came in later in the 1800s and early 1900s. Okay, on the East Coast, you've got a lot of Southern Europeans coming in. You've got a lot of Eastern Europeans coming in during that time. You still have some from Western Europe, but mostly from Eastern and Southern Europe, and those folks are bringing their religion with them. And what religions are they generally? Are they usually Protestants in Eastern and Southern Europe? No. But what kind of religions are coming in then? A lot of Roman Catholics. Again, you think of the big Italian wave of immigration during that time period? Almost 100% of them are Roman Catholic. Who else is coming in? There's some Muslims, but especially the Irish are a little bit the biggest number of Irish really before the Civil War. They're Roman Catholic, but especially a lot of people from like Poland and Russia. A lot of these people were, think of the other Abrahamic religion. A lot of Eastern Orthodox come in, and Jews as well, Jewish folks. Because they're often persecuted in these places. So they're like, hey, we can come to America. There's no Israel at that time. That's, you know. So a lot of especially from Russia and Poland and other places in Eastern Europe, a lot of Jewish people came in from 1880 to 1920. Okay? Then also, as Dick said, a lot of Eastern Orthodox as well from that part of the world. Okay? So because of all this, America has a very religious diversity in its landscape. Still overwhelmingly Christian, but you've got lots of different streams and brands, if you will, of Christianity. When people come over, they bring that with them. Okay? And oftentimes the church was very important to helping them get adjusted and established to life in America. Okay, you come to a foreign country, you don't speak the language, your culture is different. What are you going to do? You're going to gather with people that are like you. You're Polish. Oh, where's the Polish neighborhood? Oh, okay, here we go. They have grocery stores that have the food that I want. They have a Catholic church where the, you know, and all this. Okay, and down the list, the Jews are going to gather together in their communities. Oh, there's a synagogue here. There's a kosher, you know, kosher deli here. I can get the stuff I need here. Okay, so what happens is America was almost exclusively Protestant at the beginning. Okay, there were other folks, but mostly overwhelmingly Protestant. But by the mid-1800s, you're already seeing that's changing. And I think I said this last time, by about 1850, what has become the largest religious group in America, still is today, Roman Catholic Church. Okay, a lot of that was due to immigration. Okay, because and so the Roman Catholic Church comes in. So today, I think I said we have, you know, depending on your counting, and again, this is counting everyone who identifies as that. It might mean a lot of things. They might only go to Mass rarely ever. But I think there's about 70 million Roman Catholics in the United States is the number. Okay, and that has continued to go up because a lot of the immigration that we've had over the last 30 or 40 years has also been Roman Catholic folks from Latin America. Okay, even a lot of the Vietnamese that came after Vietnam War ended and the Saigon government collapsed, they were Roman Catholic too. Okay, because a lot of the Catholics in South Vietnam supported the government, okay, that fell. I taught some students years ago. There were a couple of Vietnamese families up in Franklin County, and guess what they did? They were chicken farmers, okay? Okay, that's what people do in Franklin County. And there were a couple of Vietnamese families up there, and they were like about the only Catholics in the school. You know, they drove down here. Their church was here in Commerce, this little Catholic mission, which I think moved over to Jefferson now. But anyway, so a lot of the immigrants that have come in have been Roman Catholic. But you also said have a lot of Eastern Orthodox, you've got a lot of Jews, you've got a lot of folks coming in. Protestant-wise, I guess the Southern Baptist Convention is about 16 million people. That's the biggest Protestant denomination. You've got the United Methodists, I think they have about 7 million. And then you go down the list there. Missouri Synod, we used to be in the top 10. I think we're maybe like 12 or 13 now, somewhere like that. It's kind of hard to track some of this, though, because not all denominations keep good records. We keep very good records, which isn't shocking because we're German Lutherans, right? We record everything. A lot of denominations, I mean, they just don't really track it that closely. So it gets a little bit, you know, certain churches, when they claim we have this many people, it's like, well, do they really, you know, who knows? You know, it's more of an estimate. Because they just don't have that reporting like some of the other churches do. So we've become a much more diverse country religiously. If you ask people what they identify with, most of them are still going to identify as Protestant. If they choose a religion, but they're going to be, again, Protestants are going to be spread out over tons of different groups. So the Catholic Church is the largest single organization, but when you add all the Protestants together, there's still more Protestants than Catholics. Okay, but as I said, in the last probably 10, I think it was maybe about 10 years ago, we are no longer a majority Protestant nation. Like less than 50% people will say I'm Protestant, and that's because we're up to about, I think it's 20 to 25% of the population says what now when they ask what religion you are. What do they say?
Spiritualists.
Yeah, they say nothing, actually. They call them the nuns, is what the demographics, not like Catholic nuns, but they're the people who say none. Now, does that mean that they're all atheists? No. Okay, actually, most of them would still say, what Dick said, I think, or maybe it was Pat, we're spiritual. You know, they'll believe in some things out there, but I don't really know what it is, and I maybe don't even really care that much, you know. But atheism has been growing, but still, just because someone says, when they say, what's your religion? They say none. That doesn't necessarily mean they don't believe in any type of spiritual force. But that group has grown to about a fourth of our population now, which is pretty astounding when you think even 20, 25 years ago where we've gone with that. I mean, that group just keeps growing and growing. And especially, where are you going to find most of those numbers? Age-wise, younger folks. Mostly younger folks. All right, so that's a little bit of how we became more diverse, and that's going on during this 19th century too. So let's move to the next little heading there. This is on page 5 in your notes there. And this is the modern and postmodern world from about 1900 to present. Okay, so we're getting up to about 1900 now. Okay? All right. So what's happening by the time we get to 1900, especially in America, but around the world, but we're really especially focusing on, you know, how this is impacting the U.S. What's happened in the world by 1900, by the 20th century starting, which I guess technically started in 1901, but we'll say 1900. Because you know that, right? The new century, it doesn't start until the 01, right? Okay, that's when it actually, because the 100th year would be the zero year, but just practically speaking, you know. So, you know, it's like when they had back in 2000 all the millennium stuff. Well, technically, the millennium didn't start till 2001. Okay, but, you know, hey, that's a lot easier to keep track of. Let's party in 2000, it's a new millennium. But it's technically 2001, actually, when it really started. That would be year one of that 1,000 years. All right, so what's happened in the world by this point? So say we're about at 1900 here. How has the world, especially America, changed in the last 100 years, but really even going back further than that? Gives you some there on your study guide if you want to get some.
Yeah. The cities,
the yeah. Okay, yeah, let's take those on one at a time. So again, this is, we'll say the modern world here, what we call the modern world, has really taken root. And all of us here this morning, we are children of modernism. You know, we are the people who were born in the modern age. Now, the younger folks would be more of the postmodern age, and we'll talk about what that means. But really, our mindset of how we were raised, all of us sitting here today, is this kind of modern mindset, okay? Which comes with some baggage too, but that's the way we've been raised, that there's this idea of truth, and we can discover what the truth is, and there's certain values like hard work and family that are important, and patriotism, things like all things that are on decline today. They just came out with a new survey, I think a few weeks ago. It's been in the news about that. You know, they asked people about, you know, is faith important to you? Is patriotism? And the numbers just plummeting, okay, which is, I don't think, good for our country, but it's this is what's happening, okay? But, you know, the older generations, say folks born before like 1990, this is kind of the world we grew up in, okay? Post-1990 folks, kind of a different mindset a lot of times, okay? All right, so urbanization. What that means is people are now living where? They're living in cities. Okay, this is an astounding thing. Colonial America, the largest city in America at the time of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, was what? What was the biggest city in America? Philadelphia. Very good, David. Gets the gold star. Philadelphia. It wasn't New York yet. New York, I think, was on 1820, 1830, past Philadelphia. But Philadelphia was the biggest city in America. You know how many people it had in the time of the American Revolution? About how many people it had? 50,000? That's a good guess. You're even a little high. You're in the ballpark, though. Some people say, oh, yeah, I don't know, 500,000 people? It's the biggest city. No. About 35,000 people. That's the biggest city in America in, say, 1770, 1780. That is like a decent-sized town in America today, right? Commerce has, I think, getting close to 10,000 people. Commerce would have been one of the biggest cities in America at that time. Okay? So you think of like Gainesville, maybe it might be a little higher than 35,000, but I'm saying like the city limits, but you're saying like, say, think of somewhere like Gainesville, Georgia. That's like the biggest city in America, folks. You know, if you can imagine that. Okay. Like a kind of a good size, you'd say maybe a small city or a big, small town. Okay. So that's changed by 1900. We've got multiple cities over a million people. Okay, you know, and why are the cities growing so much? Well, two reasons. And this goes into the next thing. We've had industrialization. Really, a lot of it has to do with that. Okay, so our economy in America, again, go back to colonial America, and you go back to the Middle Ages, certainly, but in colonial America, what was the most common job for people?
Farming.
Farmers. About 90% of the people worked in agriculture. 90%. Wow. Today it's like 2%. Which is really incredible when you think about it. You think about this industrialization, modernization. 2% of the people produce way more food than we need in this country. Right? I mean, think of all the food that gets thrown away every day. I mean, think about only 2% of Americans. That doesn't even mean own farms. And that 90%, they might have owned a farm, but they worked on a farm or something for somebody else. But only 2% of our workforce is in agriculture today. Not around here. It's higher than that. But I'm saying nationwide. Okay? Produces a lot of food. But back then, it took 90% of the population to produce much food. But the point is, people are living on farms. Okay? The towns are pretty small, even those that have a trade or something that live in town. But by 1900, we've had the Industrial Revolution, right? That was going on in the 19th century. People are flocking to cities. They're building factories. Okay, so instead of working on a farm, or instead of even in a business, it was like a family business. Some people, they lived in the place where they worked. They had a shop attached, or in cities it might be, even there's maybe a few rare cases of this day, like I'm thinking there's a place in Helen. There's a German bakery there. It's very good, by the way. If you ever go, called Hofer's, I recommend it. They didn't pay me any money for that. But it's a bakery, restaurant, little grocery store down here. And above it, the people who own it live up there. Okay, because I parked in their parking lot one time and I saw the guy coming out. And as I'm apt to do and drives my family crazy, I just hollered up and started talking to him, you know. And he was the guy who owned the bakery, his family, and they live upstairs. Okay, so that was kind of the model. You know, people like lived right where their shop, their blacksmith shop, or they were tailors and they lived upstairs, or they ran a little grocery store and they lived upstairs. So you grew up and that's probably what you were going to do. If your parents did that, then that's what you learned. You learned to bake, or you learned to do fix shoes, you know, cobbler, whatever. Or you were living on a family farm and you spent almost all your time with your family. Okay? So the values are passed on very closely. I mean, even today they've studied, like, you know, usually when you get older, maybe it shifts more, but your values are shaped by your environment that you grow up in. Okay, even if someone, say, they grow up in the church and they quit going to church when they're older, that's still going to have an impact on them. That's still kind of in the back of their mind, like it's formed certain things that they think are important or not. Whether they acknowledge that or not, it's there. But by the Industrial Revolution, now we have people working very differently. They're spending a lot of time away from their families, right? Parents are spending less time with their kids. You're living in an environment not with a small group of people where you know everybody, but now it's just like random people. Like you think of New York City, all these people walking by, not talking to each other because you don't know who they are. Okay, you might know the people right in your little neighborhood, but there's just millions of people there. Who are these people, right? There's this anonymity. So that is going to have a huge impact on society and religion, isn't it? If now, instead of working on a farm with your family, you get up and you go into a factory and you work 8, 10, 12 hours a day. Then you come home and you're so dog tired, you just eat something and go to sleep. And you're doing that 6 days a week. Okay, so instead of like craftsmen producing things, now it's all mass production. That's a huge change in your society. Okay, I mean, we could probably spend the whole time talking about that, but just think of sociologically, the area of sociology. How is that going to change society? Huge. Huge. We have the technology revolution that's happened in the last few decades here. Think about how that's changed everything. Think about how your kids and grandkids get information, interact with each other, spend their time. Think about how that's different than when we grew up. Okay? Even when I grew up, I mean, people didn't have cell phones. I mean, I guess there were a few cell phones in the 80s, but they were like this big, and people had to carry around in a bag or something. They were a novelty. I remember in the 1990s, my first, you know, real job working in a grocery store, a guy came in on a cell phone, and the, you know, thing was like this big, walking around in store talking, and everybody, it was like, wow, it's a cell phone, you know? But then 5 years later, by 2000, it's not that weird anymore to see people with cell phones. Now, they still weren't like looking at them all the time like today because they weren't smartphones. But still, you know, say from 1995 to 2000, cell phones just explode, okay? Everybody's getting cell phones. So think about that. We're talking about a change at least that big in how people live during the Industrial Revolution, going from the way they lived and earned a living before to now. Well, where are most of these factories located? Out in the boondocks? Cities. And people people lived very close to where they worked. Why? What don't we have yet still, 1900? Except for a few rich people have them as toys, kind of like cell phones in the 80s. Cars. Okay, so you can travel a much shorter distance. So you generally live very close to the factory or where you worked. Okay? You could walk to work, or some cities start building streetcars, and still, we don't have these big super highways. Like, you know, we have Interstate 85 that runs through our county, and then you get down, I mean, you get in Atlanta, and you've got 20, 75, 85, coming all this together. Like David knows, driving all the country as a truck driver, right? None of that existed. Okay, roads were dirt roads. So people lived closer to where they worked. Now in the 1920s, Henry Ford's Model T takes off, and that changes everything too. Think about how the world's changed because of cars. But the point is, people are living in these cities because that's where the jobs are. Okay, so you have two reasons why the cities are really exploding, all really tying back to industrialization. You're living on a farm. Farming's hard work, folks, especially back then without all this mechanization. Why don't we need as many people today? Because we've got machines that do the work of, you know, what 10 workers used to do. Now you've got this big giant tractor that does it, okay? So a farmer could have this farm of 1,000 acres growing corn or wheat out in the Midwest, and he can work it, okay? If you're living on a farm, again, they didn't understand. Working in these factories wasn't a very glamorous life. No, it was pretty tough. And what about the working conditions? They didn't have any of these things we have today, like workers' comp. You know, if you got hurt on the job, it's kind of too bad, usually. Okay, they were unsafe, unsanitary. You're working 6 days a week, 10 to 12 hours a day, making a little bit of money. But if you're on a farm, out in a small town, you're like, there's nothing here. The big lights of the big city, right? I can go work in a factory. I don't have to get up and plant crops anymore. I don't have to fight off wild animals trying to eat them. I'm just going to go do that. So a lot of people move from the small towns in the country. They move to the cities in America. They move to the big city. You also have a lot of African Americans. It's called the Great Migration. They leave the South and go north to get these jobs. Because at that time, what opportunities are available to them? Very little. Basically sharecropping, tenant farming, pretty much. So they say, well, we're going to leave here. We're going to go get jobs up in Chicago or St. Louis or New York. And that's where all these, you know, black neighborhoods developed in the cities at that time. Okay, they almost always went to the cities. Again, you go up north and you go out in the countryside, very few black people, very few African Americans. You go in the cities, a lot. Why? Because that's where they moved to from the South, because that's where the jobs were. Okay? The other thing is what we talked about. Why are the cities exploding? Immigrants. Where are most of these immigrants from 18? Now, in 1840s, a lot of the Germans went out to the Midwest. They were farmers. They started farms. But 1880 to 1920, guess where a lot of these immigrants ended up? They got off the boat. They didn't have much. And guess what they did? They went to New York City. And maybe some other, you know, maybe a little further, they had some family, say, in Boston or, you know, down here, in, you know, over here in Cleveland or Chicago. They ended up in cities, and guess what they ended up doing, most of them? Working in factories. Factories. One of the reasons we had basically this unlimited immigration is because of industrialization. The industrial leaders who had a lot of influence in politics, people with money having influence in politics, what an idea, right? It was like that back then, maybe even worse in some ways. But they liked this. Why? Because what were they getting? An endless supply of cheap labor. Okay? Okay, these guys get hurt. They can't work anymore. Oh, well, there's more poor boats coming in. Let's just hire these guys. Okay? All right, so a vast majority of these immigrants settled in cities. Okay? So we're living in an urbanized world now. We're living in an industrialized world. 1920 census, very important point in American history. When they did that, they do the census every 10 years. The 1920 census was the first census that showed more Americans lived in urban areas than they did in rural areas. So we've gone from 90% in the colonial times up to, it's a little more than 50% by 1920. That's a big change. We've now moved from a rural nation to an urban nation. China's just had this happen in the last 20 years. We had it happen over 100 years ago. Okay? We haven't looked back. Today, any guess what today, what percentage of Americans live in urban areas? What do you think?
98%. it's...
No, you're a little high there, but it's high. It's like about 80%. So only 20% of Americans live in rural areas today. Okay? It's almost completely flipped from the beginning. That has a big influence on the country, doesn't it? How we... You know, it's like, you know, you watch these election results come in, like just in Georgia, and when all these small counties come in, like the Republicans usually are piling up a big total. Now, 20, 30 years ago, it wasn't like that because, you know, Democrats were controlling Georgia and they were the more conservative party and all that. But I'm saying like now. But then the results come in from Metro Atlanta and everything flips, doesn't it? Okay, because you have to think, okay, Gwinnett County, where I'm going to be working next year, it has like 1 million people in it. It's like 1 million people in Gwinnett County. One county. It's like Fulton County. It's about 1 million people. Cobb County, close to that, I think. One county. Okay, Madison County, where I live now, has about 30,000 people. Jackson, I think, which is bigger, but it's still under 100,000. It's like maybe 80,000 in Jackson County now. Franklin County has like 25,000 people, okay? So it would take a ton of Jackson counties, Madison counties, and Franklin counties. They could vote for 90% one party, but Gwinnett comes in, you have 1 million people. Even if they're 60-40, even if they're not, I mean, that's a ton of people, right? So we see this in our country, how it's changed, right? Now, in the old days, it's completely different, right? The rural areas dominate. So in Georgia, about 50% of the state of Georgia lives in the Metro Atlanta area. So you basically have Metro Atlanta equals, which is geographically a smaller part of the state, it equals the whole rest of the state. Okay? This is the world we live in now. So again, a lot of this goes back to this time. Okay? All right? So we're living in an industrial and urbanized. What else has happened now? We're living in a more global. It's more global. Okay? All right, now there's always been international trade. You go back to the American Revolution, that was one of the causes of it. Because Britain said, you can only trade with us. He said, well, what if we want to trade with the Dutch or the French? This isn't fair. And we want to go with Adam Smith's idea of free trade, you know. But especially by the time you get to 1900, what's happened? America has become a world power. Okay? We get involved in World War I in 1917, which is basically a European issue, but we get drawn into it. You know, but now we're involved in a European war, basically. Okay? A lot of this stuff we're producing is going overseas. We're buying stuff from overseas. So it's become a much more global society. The world, you know, it's a cliche, but we say that such a technology. The world has become a smaller place. Okay? Reagan has literally been on the other side of the world for 3 months. Literally. I mean, in Thailand. She's coming back next week. And my wife and I have mentioned this a couple times, like, it doesn't really seem like she's been gone that long. Why? You know why? She calls all the time on FaceTime, not even just voice. There's her face. She's showing us what she's doing. Okay? You couldn't imagine that even 20 years ago, probably. There was no FaceTime or anything like that. You know, there was a time in our history when iPhones didn't exist. I know that's hard for, like, the younger generation, like, you know, your grandkids and my two younger kids, like, yep, it's like, we didn't have any of this stuff. Okay, if you went to Thailand for 3 months, we might get a letter. Maybe a phone call probably cost like $100 or something, you know? So I remember we called home from England back in the late 80s and went on a business trip with my dad. The phone, you know, you had phone booths back then. You know, those red British phone booths, like those classic. And they had like a little meter on there, and it would go down like how much money you had left. And I remember my dad talking on the phone to my mom, and I'm putting coins in. Like, you know, it's like you could see it. It was like a countdown. Like, you know, like by the second, you know, like feeding coins in like 5 minutes, you know. But think of how it's different now. It's a global, where you get on a plane and go anywhere in the world. Okay, just about. All right. So all of this has changed. Now, all of that to be said, now that you had your little history lesson, we have to understand the context of what's going on. That the world of 1900 to 1920, say, even the late 1800s, it is, in all of these ways, sociologically, economically, demographically, it's way different than the time when Christianity first started, isn't it? It's way different than the time when Christianity was the dominant thing in Europe and then later in America. So all of these things, I mean, this is changing thing. I mean, we have to, every new thing that comes out, think of how technology has impacted the church. I mean, we saw that in the pandemic, but you know, there's some good things, some opportunities we have, like we're doing the sermon audio, but there's also some bad things. Some people might say, well, I'll just stay home in my PJs and watch church, you know, I don't need to come, right? Okay, and in many ways, I think technology has become people's false god for many people. What's the one thing they can't live without? The internet or their phone or whatever. Okay? Probably not coincidentally, what did Steve Jobs choose as the symbol for Apple? An apple, and what does that apple have? The bite taken out of it. I mean, this is referencing back to Garden of Eden stuff, right? Okay? All right? So think about that, right? So how has all this changed the world? It's become many people's god. Steve Jobs, by the way, guess what? He was raised as an LCMS Lutheran. Did you know that? He's another one of ours that got away. Okay, later in life, he kind of questioned all kinds of things, religion, and he said, the new religion is technology. That's the new religion. And I still remember this was years ago. I don't know if this is something he said, but somebody had an Apple like computer sticker on the back of their car, and it said, bow to the new god. I've never forgotten. I think it was like in college and I saw that. I was like, wow. And it's only become more true in 20 years since I've seen that. Okay? I think later he kind of got into Buddhism or something later in his life, but you know, he was raised in a Christian home. And kind of came to believe though that technology was the new way, okay. And this is a rabbit trail, but think about this. Think about how Apple operates. And I love Apple products. I mean, I've got one here. I think they're so user friendly and they're very reliable products. So I'm not saying throw away all your Apple stuff. But think about this. How does Apple even now operate as a company? They tell you what you want. They don't necessarily respond to consumer demand. They tell you what you want. They tell you, you will want this. It's almost like a religious idea. It's not, Microsoft operates kind of differently. They operate more on consumer demand. What do people want? We'll give it to them. But Apple basically tells you, this is what you want. You will like it. Okay, they do. I mean, think about it. I mean, you know, with the phones now and the computers, you have to buy all this stuff that used to come with it, that used to be built into it. It's not anymore. Why did they do that? Because people wanted it that way? I don't think so. That's because this is the way it's going to be. And you will buy it, you will like it. Okay, so even think about that. Even operates, come on, that's a religion. It's not taking a poll to say, you will want this and you will buy it. Then we say, okay, and we do. Okay? Might complain, oh, it doesn't come with headphones anymore, but we still buy it. Okay, still buy it. Yeah. Okay. All right. So let's get back to this. So how is all this impacting religion? Okay. Well, we said the 19th century, the 1800s is sometimes seen as this great century for Christianity. But as there often is, there's undercurrents, right, going on. What kind of things are also advancing during this time? A lot of ideas, and some of this is rooted in the Enlightenment, modern science and technology. Now, I mentioned that Apple, nothing's new under the sun. Because many people began to look to what in the 1800s and say, this will solve all of man's problems. It wasn't computers, but it was what? Technology. Okay? Think of all the inventions at this time, like the telephone. Okay? Like the factory system being perfected. There was even a whole science called Taylorism. They were just getting Taylor how we can have the most efficient factories. I think it was Calvin Coolidge says, the man who builds a factory builds a temple. The man who works in a factory worships there. Okay, very kind of, you know, describing what's going on here. So the idea is that technology and industrialization, that will solve all of our problems. Did it? No. Because that technology can be used, I mean, these poor folks working in these factories, breathing in all this smoke, not so good for them. We also create all these new weapons that are used in World War I and kill more people than we can ever imagine. You have machine guns, airplanes, tanks, all these things, submarines. The Germans building these U-boats. But that's what people are looking to. Technology, just like today, saying, well, this is going to solve all of our problems. We're in the modern world now. There was a lot of hope in that man was good, and so we can fix the problems in the world. So all of these things are going on. So where does that leave Christianity then? Well, it said Christianity faced new challenges and new opportunities. All right, so there were many people saying, well, everybody's into all this new stuff now. How is the church going to be relevant to the people? Again, nothing's understood. People are saying the same thing now, aren't they? How do we keep the church relevant? Well, first of all, the church is always relevant because God is relevant, okay? We don't need whiz-bangery. We just, you know, God is God, so he's relevant. I mean, that's the bottom line. David?
It's changed people's way of thinking. They think that they can fix the problem themselves.
Yes. Yeah, because we have all this event. I mean, we can build an iPhone, for goodness sake. Surely we can make people better. Okay? That's at the root of a lot of it. You hit the nail on the head there. I did that. Man can fix it. This is, again, going back to the Garden of Eden. This is as old as the Garden of Eden. We know better than God. We can do this better than God. The Tower of Babel, right? We can build this big building up to heaven. We don't need God. I love that. It's such a great Lutheran law gospel illustration, because what were people trying to do? They're trying to build up to God. What's Christianity about? What's the truth about God coming down to man? It's the exact opposite. Okay, but that's what we're always trying to do, right? We can do this. We can fix this. We can build a better mousetrap, whatever. Okay, and technology all has its place, but it can easily become people's God. So how does Christianity fit into all this? How do we stay relevant? Well, this idea, this is a good term to know. It's on the paper there. Higher criticism. I'll put that in quotation marks. But this is an area of theology that really explodes during this time. And the roots of it go back even further. I was reading a little bit about it even this morning and some of the folks that were involved in this. But you really, in the 1800s, you have several guys. Friedrich Schmelmacher. He was a leader in this. Adolf Harnack. Oh, these names sound like they're coming from where?
Germany.
Yeah. So, okay, Germans, those of us German heritage, a lot of this is our fault. We gave the world Martin Luther, but we also gave the world Schmelmacher, Boltman, Harnack, all these guys. Okay? So a lot of this is actually centered coming out of Germany. Okay? Then it spreads around the world. So what is higher criticism? Why is it bad? Well, the idea is this, I didn't even mention this, what science and technology, the theory of evolution comes out mid-1800s. Okay, again, we said before, not everyone who believes in Darwinian evolution is an atheist, but certainly every atheist would have to believe in it because it's how they try to answer how we got here, right? Without God. All right, so what does the church do with that? This seems all the rage, very scientific, right? All this. So what does the church do with that? All these new discoveries that are being made. It's like dinosaurs start being dug up, okay, at this time. They're like, oh, dinosaurs. The word dinosaur didn't even exist until the late 1800s, okay? How does the church deal with all this? You got people doing new things, interested in new things. The world's changed. You got all these new ideas. Well, the higher critics, what they started doing is they said, we need to look at the Bible as what? This is really the root of what higher criticism is about. And I put higher there because, I mean, I would say this is not the higher way to go. This is not. But what do the higher critics say? All these guys, I mentioned some of their names. What do we do with the Bible? How do we study the Bible? Do we study it like Martin Luther and John Calvin and Huss and all these great luminaries from the Reformation? How do we study the Bible, they would say?
Historically.
We look at the Bible as yet another historical document. Okay? We don't look at the Bible, they say, as the authoritative word of God and everything flows from that. What we do is we study the Bible, we study the manuscripts and things we have, and we make scientific or, you know, academic conclusions about it. We study it like any other document we would from history. What's the problem with that? Yeah, at the root of it, what are we doing? That we're putting fallible man over the infallible word of God. I mean, that's the root of it. Rather than, you know, how all those guys I mentioned and faithful theologians today, you know, when I'm preparing for a sermon, I say, here's what God's word says. How do I understand what God is telling me, and how do I communicate to people that? A higher critic would say, no. Is this even really what God said, or did it get lost through the ages, or really what do I think that means, and how can I communicate that? So you're putting fallible man above God's word, essentially, is the root of it. You're studying the Bible like you would any other document, the Code of Hammurabi, or the U.S. Constitution, or whatever it is, Homer's Iliad and the Odyssey. You know, how much of this is original to Homer? How much of that? So you get all these theories about, this is when you start hearing these things a lot, like, well, Moses didn't really write the Pentateuch. You know, there were these like four sources they drew from, you know, the JD, whatever the letters were, you know, theory and all this. Well, maybe Moses didn't really part the Red Sea. Maybe that's just trying to teach us something. Well, maybe Jesus didn't really say this here. This worked itself into the text later. So these guys are, you know, they're very intelligent, they're very academic, but they're studying the Bible in kind of a critical way. Rather than saying, this is God's word, what can we learn from it? They're saying, well, what is God's word? What's true? What's not? And what does this source say and all that? Okay? So that's going on, and that's taking root during this time. Okay, and then when you have that belief, you can say something like, well, okay, we've traditionally thought the world's a few thousand years old, but now we got this evolution idea, so we got to work that into the Bible somehow. You know, maybe that's just a story, and, you know, telling us something, you know, because we got these dinosaur bones now, you know, so how does that fit in? So they're adopting a lot of these ideas, and this is how they're approaching the Bible. Okay, so these higher critics rejected ideas that Christianity was, first of all, it says the seminaries of Europe, especially Germany, was exported to the U.S. These higher critics rejected ideas that Christianity was outdated and organized religion had limited value. But unfortunately, they were heretical in many ways. This theological school did not accept the Bible as true and believed it was a historical document to be studied and dissected like other historical documents. So what did they do? They often rejected many miracles as literally true. Some even went as far as to reject what? That we're celebrating right now. I love David when he came in today, said, Christ is risen, right? I love it. Because we're still in Easter, right? What did they even reject, some of these guys? They went as far as to even reject the Word of God, and specifically the resurrection. Some of them said, well, that really didn't happen. That's a story, you know, is embellished by early Christians. Again, the Bible makes it very clear, but again, they're not accepting the Bible as purely the Word of God. If you don't believe in the resurrection, guess what? You can't be a Christian. Because that's the cornerstone of the whole thing. This is that important. I mean, read 1 Corinthians 15. Okay? Now, they were rejecting it for... There was different things going on because they were influenced by this Greek philosophy that said the body is bad, and why would I want to be resurrected with the body and all this? But the idea is that Paul said, this is it. You know, if you're rejecting the resurrection, you know, this is a fatal error. But some of these guys went even as far as that. Or they'd say, well, we don't really know if it happened or not. And you get all these crazy theories like the swoon theory, like he passed out and revived in the tomb, or maybe the disciples really did steal the body. All this kind of stuff, it just doesn't hold up. You know, it's like, how is this even going to happen? Okay? But they even reject that. Like, we read the read. It was pretty laborious, but our seminary president reads some of Boltman, who was a 20th century, very influential Lutheran, supposedly theologian. But he, you know, he had the same ideas. You know, he rejected most of the miracles. The resurrection is just kind of allegorical. And you're like, oh, you know. And so that's a lot of these guys where they were going, okay? All right, but they didn't reject Christianity outright. And here's the irony of it, and it's the same way today with these folks that say these things. They thought to save Christianity in the modern world, to make it relevant for this new age where all this is going on, what do we have to do to save it?
We got to make it fit.
We got to make it relevant. We got to change it. Again, all these guys that I mentioned, they all would tell you they're Christians. They're all like, we're faithful Christians, but you don't believe in this or that. But this, no, we're trying to save Christianity. This may not be a perfect illustration, but none of them are. Gorbachev, when he came to power in the Soviet Union in 1985, did he want to get rid of communism? No. Did he want to get rid of the Soviet Union? No. But what did he do? He said, we've got to change it. We've got to have a new communism, perestroika, glasnost, that it is more open and things like that. But he was smart enough to look at the Soviet Union's failing. You know, we're trying to spend all this money to keep up with America, the military, but we can't do it. We're banking. People are going to stores and there's nothing there. He realized it wasn't working what they were doing. So he said, we've got to change communism to save it. But what happened? Did he save it?
No.
What happened to the Soviet Union? Doesn't exist anymore.
It's split up.
So he tried to save it by doing something very different. Didn't work. The church does this all the time. So these guys, in trying to save Christianity, what I would say is, what were they really doing? They're gutting it from the inside out. So you may have something that's called Christianity, but a Christianity without resurrection, folks, a Christianity without miracles, a Christianity without Christ's atoning death on the cross, that's not really Christianity. You can call it Christianity all you want, but you've ripped the guts out of it. And frankly, I don't really have any interest in a Christianity like that. I've got a lot of other things I could be doing if none of that stuff's true. I could be out on the golf course this morning. Why not? If none of the stuff's in there true, or I don't know what's true and what's not, I just kind of believe in God and try to do some good things. You know, why am I even here? You know? But the irony is, they're trying to save Christianity, but they're gutting it from within. Okay? It happens today. The church has to change. Maybe we don't really need to believe any of this anymore because young people don't like that. Okay? So we at least, you know, just stop talking about that. Or we say you don't have to believe this anymore to be a Christian. Whatever. Okay? Same thing's happening today. Okay? So these are the higher critics. Now, if we don't focus on the supernatural, if we don't focus on the death and resurrection of Jesus, what are these guys going to say we should focus on then? I mean, what's left? How can we make Christianity great in the modern age and people appeal to people? Well, maybe through scholarship. We're a bunch of smart guys and we've done all this cool research. But really, what's the practical thing, the boots on the ground? What are you going to tell people? Why should they follow Jesus? Why should they be involved in the church? What's left? Really, you've got a couple things you can focus on. It's called the social gospel and then morality. Christianity makes you a good person. You're a nicer person if you're a Christian. You care about other people. You give money to worthy causes. And what I mean by social gospel there is that they would say, we in the church, we focus too much on the hereafter, the eternity, heaven and hell. What we really need to focus on in the modern world is what? The here and now, helping people. We've got all these people working in factories that are basically, you know, they say you're being taken advantage of. We need to fix that. We got children going down in coal mines. Let's fix that. So they have some points. Are there things that need to be addressed? Yes. But is that the gospel? No. So the social gospel is, and I heard one guy quip one time, the social gospel, because every generation needs a fake gospel to replace the real one, you know? And so this is yet another, but this idea is social gospel. So what if we gut Christianity of the atonement and resurrection and miracles and even a rock solid belief on the Bible, what do we have left? We still got a lot of things Jesus said about helping other people, don't we? Jesus, we can follow him as a good moral example for us. You know, even if he didn't really die on the cross and rise from the dead, that teaches us something important, they would say. Self-sacrifice for others. You know, pushing through, you know, these kind of things. So I say, well, the church needs to focus on helping people. And again, let's help people. I'm all for that. But that's what they want to focus on. And then morality. You know, be a good person. So this is really what they're reducing the church to. If they got all this other stuff. All right, we're almost out of time. So I'm going to give you a word to leave you with, and we'll talk a little bit next week about the reaction to this, because not everybody bought into this, thank goodness. This is what's called modernism. Okay, modernism was a term we probably don't use too much anymore, but they used all the time 120 years ago. So this is called modernism, where basically the church is trying to adapt Christianity to the modern world. And with that would come folks who would be more accepting of ideas like Darwin's theory, and, you know, where we got the Bible really wasn't the people who thought we wrote it and things like that. Okay? So these were the modernists. These were the modernists. They were trying to kind of morph Christianity into what they thought would fit this new modern world that we spent the first 30 minutes talking about. Okay, so this school of thinking, the higher criticism, the social gospel, this is kind of all under this umbrella of what we call modernism. So by the time we get to 1900, the early 1900, this is really working its way in. In the late 1800s, some too, but really by the time you get to 1900, this is a very strong force in Christianity. Some of the leaders of the church in Europe and America have been through these guys' seminary classes, okay? And now they're out in congregations preaching, and what are they preaching, okay? All right? And again, they might not have been able to come out and say on Easter Sunday, you know, this is nice, but it didn't really happen. They probably would have been run out of the church, as they probably should have been, right? Okay? I wouldn't go back. Okay, I don't want to rush the stage or whatever, but I wouldn't go back there. Past it. Okay? But if they have even doubts in their mind, is that going to influence? Yeah. What they're teaching people is really this is the kind of sermons we need. We need social gospel stuff. We need morality and things like that. That's what we need to be preaching. Okay, folks. All right. We're out of time. Any questions on this now that we've had our turn of the century history lesson, but then we've also seen, well, what kind of trends are coming in? How is this impacting the church? But again, fortunately, not everybody bought into this modernism idea. A lot of folks did. Okay, but there was a reaction to this. There was a reaction to this called fundamentalism. And so we've looked at modernism today. Next week, we'll take a little look at fundamentalism and what that is. And it had its good and bad points, too. Okay. Again, don't get too far ahead of myself, but the Missouri Synod, we didn't buy into this. Okay. And actually, if you look at, we put out a major statement of faith around this time. These are the things we believe and we reject. And why did we do that? Because of this. We were saying this stuff's a bunch of bunk, basically. We still believe this. You know, God created the world. Christ rose from the dead. All these things. Okay, yes, we believe in helping people. We've been doing that, actually. But that's not the gospel. The gospel is Christ crucified and risen from the dead for our salvation and forgiveness of sins. That has to be the heart of the church. Okay? All right, any other questions?